This is Skillful Means Podcast, spiritual nourishment for yoga practitioners and teachers. I'm Jennifer O'Sullivan.
And I'm Sarah Jane Shangra. Join us every other week for conversations on integrating the Buddha Dharma, Taoism, and spiritual psychology with yoga.
Welcome, dear listeners. It's such a joy to be thinking about you as we record. We hope you're well. And before we get to today's topic, we want to take a moment to let you know that we are yearning to know more about you and find ways to interact with you in real time or close to it.
For sure. I have to say, I can't help wondering who you are. We know estimates of our community size and have some geographic data, but that's about it. The retreat last November was a wonderful way to connect closely with some of you, and we love receiving emails, that's for sure. But we need more connective tissue. Yin teacher pun, forgive me.
Oh my goodness. The good news here is that we are starting a book club. The gist of it is that we all read a book together, like a book club, and we'll discuss it on our March show. And you can share your thoughts and or questions about the book in two ways. The first one is that you can send us an email to feedback@skillfulmeanspodcast.com, or you can leave us a voicemail on our new SpeakPipe account, which is www.speakpipe.com/skillfulmeanspodcast. Try to get those comments to us by March 1st so that we have time to weave them into the show. And not to forget, our first book is Adyashanti's End of Your World.
I'm very much looking forward to this, though I admit I have not started the reread.
Me neither.
Okay. I'll get on it.
Same.
Yeah. But now it's time to introduce the topic of the day, which is the expanded opportunities we lifelong learners have since the pandemic pushed so many organizations and teachers to virtual delivery of trainings and retreats.
Online learning means increased access in many ways. You know, for some, though, online is a letdown, you know, and it's definitely not the same. The transmission from teacher to student doesn't always have the same energy. And for some, the opportunities continue to remain out of reach. But there are some really different things that are different in a good way. And it can feel like a golden age of continuing education, learning, self-growth, self-development, training, you name it.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a lot out there.
So much.
Yeah. One can train with a bucket list teacher now, right? Without traveling halfway around the world.
Yeah. And as things usually go, too much of a good thing may not be such a good thing all the time.
So there has been an interesting mix of circumstances that have conspired to create this golden age of learning. Not only are studios and individual yoga and mindfulness teachers moving their offerings online, but also the larger centers with visiting teachers, such as Kripalu, are moving online, and the decentralized training programs that have no brick-and-mortar location but offer their trainings at various centers here and there in the world, they're slowly moving online. The decentralized credentialing bodies with matriculating students who have traveled to study and accumulate credits are moving their programs online after perhaps some resistance, I've noticed in a few cases. So where before there were requirements to train in person in order to receive credit in some cases, they've had to relax their rules in order to keep certification programs going and students matriculating.
Yeah. You know, I think there's some really good positives, right? You know, these programs that used to be limited to the number of people that could either fit in the program room or in the accommodations that were available can certainly accept more people now. So there's not this, not necessarily this sense that, you know, there's this scarcity to get into a program. Mm-hmm. Although that's not true of all of them. Some of them are keeping the model the way they had it offline. You know, and another thing about these online trainings and retreats and other opportunities is that they're in a way less expensive. Maybe the tuition hasn't changed, but the fact that we don't have to travel to get there or to book accommodation, that's always been something that holds me back a lot of times. So there's that. And I think for me, this opportunity has enabled me to get into a few things that might have been put off several years, maybe, for me to, you know, get into them and also have the money to do it. So I'm very happy about that part of it. But, you know, another part of it, too, is that it's a little bit easier for me because I have a child at home and a husband that typically travels a lot to get some of these trainings into my life. You know, before, if I wanted to go, say, do a program with Sarah, I would have to coordinate with my husband to make sure he wasn't going to be out of town at the same time. That was always a really tricky juggle, especially if you have to plan something so far in advance. So being able to fit it into my life in that way has been a little bit easier.
A similar situation for me, the need to completely clear your schedule, that it was never insurmountable, but it was a big effort. Clear your schedule so you could travel and be at this place without your phone on, you know, for your training or your retreat. That's not really necessary. I mean, it is in some cases, but now a lot of the retreats that are being offered online are being offered with like a little wink and a nod that you may not fully be in retreat because it might not be possible for you to do so when you're at home. Mm. You might have children or you might have some responsibilities, perhaps you're a caretaker for someone, and you can still participate in the retreat, you know, be in the Zoom sessions for an hour or two or three here or there over the course of the day, over the course of several days. But in between, before and after, you can feed your child and get the laundry done and maybe even see the one client who you really felt like you couldn't move off the weekly schedule. You know, there's more flexibility. And, you know, even as I say this, I'm feeling a little sheepish because that's not the case in all programs. In some programs, I'm thinking about how there are extensive guidelines about how you really need to find a way to retreat and to hold noble silence and to relax everyday activities as fully as possible. And others, as I said, there seems to be in the languaging of the guidelines a bit of a wink and a nod, like we're doing the best we can, all of us, like come and have the benefit of this retreat, knowing that, you know, in this day and age, what a retreat looks like is going to be slightly different for every participant. And that's kind of what we did, right? Yeah. In our retreat in November. So we certainly were inviting people to adapt a few suggested retreat formats and schedules to what would really work for them, knowing that they weren't likely alone and silent in some place.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
It's an interesting juggle. Something that you just said reminded me that, you know, as independent contractors, as many of us teachers are, when we go on retreat, that's a whole week, maybe 2 weeks, that we don't get any income. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I hadn't thought about before, but the ability to do a program during the day and still teach my Monday night class is not insignificant, you know?
That's a big deal.
And then something else that you said while I was listening to you that triggered for me, and you and I have talked about this outside of the podcast a few times, is that tension I sometimes feel, especially in Buddhist communities, that as a person in the stage of my life who has children, well, mm-hmm. one child, so many programs are just not available to me, you know, because they happen at a time when I'm in the before time driving my child around or, you know, needing to be home for dinner. We try to have family dinner. And so it just doesn't work for me to, oh, I'm just going to go at 7 o'clock on a Wednesday night to be with the Sangha. And to hear you say, oh, and then there are these programs that are like, even if you're at home, you have to stick to the program and you have to do this and this and this. It's like, oh, I'm feeling that same energy I get around like, oh, this is not for me because this is my life stage. And I think you remember that I bailed out of a program that I was going to be able to do in the spring last year, had everybody stayed at their office job or stayed in the classroom. It was completely doable during the day when the program sessions were going to happen. And then when everything came home, it became instantly overwhelming. I just couldn't do it. And I remember sitting in on the first call and looking at everybody on the screen. And I was not the youngest person in the group, and I'm not even young. But I was clearly in a life stage that was not the target for the program. And when I mentioned it to the people, can you put me in the fall retreat? I just can't handle this. They were shocked and they were surprised. I was the only person that said, I can't do this. This is overwhelming. I'm now homeschooling and doing all this stuff. I'm just sitting with how different everybody's life circumstances are, even still. And amidst all of this accessibility, I'm feeling that what a lot of people are saying, you know, we're all in the same storm, but we're not in the same boat. And I'm feeling that right now.
Yeah, I sense that. I sense that. And I understand. And I, you know, I myself right now, I'm contemplating a series of retreats that have those very strict guidelines. And I'm just wondering, you know, I don't have a child at home all the time, but I have a child at home on the weekends. And well, he's 15, he's super active, but I mean, I'm really close with and adore my stepson. And I, because he's not here a lot, our time feels even more precious.
Yeah.
And a couple of weeks ago, I did spend the weekend that he was here in my room retreating for a particular program. And it was with a heavy heart because I was missing out and I wouldn't see him for another week. So different situation from yours and slightly different challenges. It's like, I don't want to give up 1 second, you know, that I do have with him. So, and I'm thinking too about how for every program that is trying to remain extremely, you know, I don't want to say strict, but maybe that is the right word. For every program like that, there are programs more like workshops or weekend programs where every session is being recorded and they do allow you to watch the recording later. So I have signed up for some learning opportunities where they don't fit at all with my schedule. But I know I can watch. I'll have access because I registered. I'll have access to the recordings later. And then it becomes, I'll be honest.
You know where I'm going.
Do I get back to it? You know?
So. I know myself. I rarely get back to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, overall here, what we're talking about is a shift, a big shift in access. Yeah. And You know, I'm reminded just about a week ago when I was on that retreat. It was a final retreat for a teacher training program, and we had this wonderful lecture from Jack Kornfield, who related the teaching about how precious it is to be alive while the Dharma is being transmitted, like in this, you know, huge time scale sense, you know, like it's precious that we're alive right now, even more precious that we're alive at the time it's being transmitted and we get exposed to it. We receive the teachings, right? And then even more precious than that is the opportunity to become part of the transmission. It's considered extremely rare. And maybe slightly less so, you know, for this big shift that we've been experiencing. Okay, so there are pitfalls. And one of them that I've been noticing in this golden era of trainings and access is that I can sign up for too many trainings at a time, right?
I don't mean to laugh at you, Sarah Jane, but I already knew this.
I know. And I know I'm not the only one. I've had some hilarious conversations with other teachers where we're just like, what are we doing? Yeah. So one of the things I'm not sure we mentioned about access is that when trainings can invite more people in because the actual physical space is not a limitation, because they can do that, sometimes they will charge less per person. So I think because of that, I have felt a little bit of a rush to do some of these trainings now because they are more affordable than they might be once they're back in person with, as you pointed out, the airfare and perhaps lodging and everything else to boot. So there may be other reasons, but in any case, this is a little pattern of mine that I've noticed in the past year. And, you know, when I do this, when I'm moving through more than a couple programs in a given month or 6-week period or months long period, whatever it is, when I do this, I'm really robbing myself of the time to be with the teachings and to like marinate in them, you know, or spend time with what's novel about them for me. I don't have the opportunity to integrate the practices because sometimes for a given program, there are prescribed daily practices, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're in three programs and they each have prescribed daily practices, you got to make some choices. And that's really, it means I miss out on the full experience and the expression of the teaching that the teacher intended when they put together all the guidelines and the practices. So, you know, I'm also thinking about how I used to really enjoy going to the references, the source material that a teacher will refer to in like the back of the manual or in passing in their lecture, so that I could really feel into the context of the teachings that they were conveying. I would check out those things, those other teachers they refer to, the books that they said they admired and enjoyed. And you can't do that, you know, when you are in more than one training. You can't do extra. You can't do extra in a given training. So this has been, you know, something I'm noticing is that the more I do, actually, the more I miss out and the more I'm staying on the surface with a given training rather than going deep with a given training. And, you know, things aren't finding their way into my practice as organically as they might. So, you know, I'm also thinking that there's a situation with teaching here, right? So you can't integrate much of what's novel for you into your teaching all at once. You know, if you have several things that are making their way into your practice from some of the influences that you've had the opportunity to be exposed to, like you can't, I don't know, like say I teach an hour-long class, I'm not going to change 5 things about it. You know?
Yeah.
It's just going to be disjointed. I would never try, but I'm just mentioning it as another drawback of doing too much at once. Because if you're doing only one, there can be this organic shift from taking something into your own practice and eventually bringing it into your teaching, you know? And I'm thinking about how I had this funny situation last year where I was training in both a very Buddhist, Buddha Dharma based mindfulness program and a secular mindfulness program. And, you know, they're complementary, but they're different in particular purposeful ways. And a couple of times I found myself when I was guiding some meditation, sometimes I have a script, sometimes I'm off script, sometimes I'm just teaching from what's present. And a couple of times I found myself sort of over-explaining a teaching in both like from through the Buddhist lens and through the secular lens. And I just don't think that was probably helpful to my students. I like to geek out about the differences. And when I feel into the differences and notice the differences in approaches, that for me has an accelerative effect in terms of understanding the overall or my relationship, understanding my relationship to the overall content, but not great as a teaching style. So, So the temptation to do a lot is there, but not such a great idea.
Yeah. I'm thinking too about how some of us can get almost, I think it is a real thing to become a bit addicted to learning, which, I'm sort of pulling from some IFS terminology a little bit, but addictions through the IFS lens, they're fulfilling a need in our lives, the activity, whatever it is, that helps us to feel better in some way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes habituated because we don't learn any other way to feel better. And that becomes the only thing. And I think certainly learning for some, not for everybody, but for I think people like you and people like me, it does give us a dopamine hit.
I
come out of trainings and I'm just like lit up and my eyes are all wide. I probably look like somebody who you know, took an amphetamine. sometimes not, but I usually am really hyped up after learning something new. That's just my nature. And I actually, before coming on today to do the recording, I looked it up. Is this a thing? And it is. It is a thing.
Oh,
people. Okay. It's not a common thing, but there's definitely anything that kind of releases a dopamine hit, you know, can have that effect of, we want that hit again. We want that hit again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not saying that that's what's going on with you, but I think it was interesting to name it. And then I get curious because, again, through the IFS lens, in my own experience, what am I trying to make myself feel better about by getting this dopamine hit?
Right.
You know, what am I trying to paper over or accommodate or get an end run, and it might be inner critic stuff, you know, and the way that I talk to myself.
Mm-hmm. Sense of inadequacy.
Mm-hmm. And imposter syndrome, of course. Like, how many of us listening to, you know, you don't have to email if you don't want to.
Please don't. Our inbox would be full.
You know, how many of us feel like, I'm doing the training because I need to maybe get that 500-hour certificate from Yoga Alliance,
right?
Because that 500-hour is somehow going to elevate me to some kind of exalted status that I didn't have before, you know? You know, and worrying this is a competition too, right?
Mm-hmm.
With other people that circulate in our stream. So there's that for sure.
For sure. That's why I was joking that you should not let us know because our inbox would be full. I just think that's so common, Jen.
Yeah. Oh, I've absolutely done it. Absolutely done it. You know, and I could, if I were brave enough, I could even tell you all about the particular people I felt competitive with. And it was not because they were some of them were even friends of mine. There's that little voice like, oh, their classes have more people in it, or their workshop did better than mine on a similar topic. And you just start getting this like uncomfortable feeling. And it's like, okay, I'm going to go take another training. And then it's another bullet on my list, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's a real thing that we have to be mindful of.
I agree.
The other thing is FOMO, fear of missing out, especially right now. You named it earlier when you said that they were dropping prices and then you've got to like get in on it before.
Yeah.
Before it's not available at that price anymore.
Now or never.
Yeah. And that's a marketing tactic that is really uncomfortable. And sometimes I get emails from people who want to sign up for my program. And I can hear it in the email that they're feeling that FOMO. And they'll say like, Jen, I really want to do this, but I don't know if I can make it work. When are you going to offer it again? And you know, in the now time, I really don't know. And I hate being able to not give them an answer because I want to take the FOMO out of their calculation. But other people are using that FOMO to get us to sign up. So I would just encourage you to be really discriminating and evaluating the marketing of these programs. Not, you know, most of them are good, but I have seen, you know, some of these summits, right? Those training summits. And this is before the pandemic, but oh my gosh, the like get it now energy is so heightened around those summits. And you know what I'm talking about, right?
The all the experts.
5,000 interviews in one day spread over 5 days. You can't possibly watch it all. And so then you're like, maybe I should pay the $197 for all the recordings that I know myself I'll never watch. So I've kind of been burned enough by summits that I don't even read the emails anymore. But all of that energy is there with those things.
That's so true. The summits, they're kind of, you know, I kind of resent it because I feel as though they are preying on a sense of desperation that some of us can have at times.
That same imposter syndrome. And our inner critics, they know we have them and they're needling them a bit. I totally believe it.
I just, one thing I keep in mind for myself is that if I do take everyone up on their offer, I, you know, may enjoy some learning, but I also will likely be using my time to remain sort of in shallow waters in several areas and several topic areas, rather than have the opportunity to go deep into one or two areas over a longer period of time, which I think for me anyway is what I enjoy most. It takes more patience and time, but there's more benefit to me and I think to my students. It's definitely the way I want to proceed, but those forces around us, those summits, are definitely trying to pull me out of that commitment, you know? But I'm continuing a theme from last year in my learning, and I'm adding one theme this year. But I'm very clear about it for myself, you know, and I'm trying not to skip around. And I think this is the way you play it too, right?
Yeah, I typically will focus on one topic area for as long as it takes for me to feel like I've gone where I'm going to go with it. I've done that. Gosh, it's been a few years now. I don't know how many years, but I spent about a year. I got really motivated to learn fascia anatomy. You know, yin teacher, all about fascia. So I did all the trainings I could. I read all the books. I got some serious academic books to dig into that topic. And then I felt like, okay, I've gotten to the point where I know what I need to know to do the work that I do. And I could stay there for sure. I could keep going. I got enticed the other day by a really very specific fascia topic that I was like, "Ooh, that sounds cool." But then I was like, "This isn't applicable to my work." And this particular topic is a work topic. It's not a self-development topic. So I'm pretty clear on that. And similarly, I spent a little bit of time wondering about whether or not I wanted to go to acupuncture school.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what I did was I bought a couple of acupuncture textbooks on the recommendation of the person that I see, and I read them.
There you go. Brilliant.
And in doing so, I realized, oh, actually, this is not an area that I want to pursue because there are aspects of this work that don't appeal to me at all. And I wouldn't want to spend my days doing that. So that was a good move on my part because it backed me off of what would have been a 3-year commitment.
That's really smart.
Jumped in, you know. I this past year I've mainly been focusing on IFS stuff, and I still am because I think there's a lot of depth there, and I've only scratched the surface, and I'm continually intrigued. So I'll keep poking around in that space for a while, I think.
Mm.
So I think it's helpful for people if they're trying to be a little more strategic about what they choose to do. In addition to figuring out thematic areas that you want to dive into, but it's also just, like I said, envisioning your life 1 year, 2 years, however many years into the future, and really ask yourself, is this something that I'm going to care about in that amount of time? And if I'm a teacher and I'm doing some skill building, is that a topic area I actually want to be teaching on?
This is nice and practical. That's so smart.
Yeah. And then I've got, I'm coming back to this FOMO that clearly makes me so irritated. some of the ways that I counteract that, first of all, I've been burned a few times and come out the other end going, that was a waste of time and money. And that will definitely hone my discernment skills is getting a little bit shafted. But I also am very, very conscientious about my budget, except for my 200 hour, which I obviously hadn't been doing any yoga teaching before I did my 200 hour training. So that was personal money. But I have never done a program since with personal money from my previous job. I've only ever waited until I accumulated enough income from teaching to then pay for the next thing I wanted to do.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's impressive. I think I did the opposite, I'm embarrassed to say. Well, no, but I was very clear on it. I was keeping a part-time job around for a while for many different reasons. Health insurance included. But also it was an area of competency for me, and I had grown in this field. But a big benefit of it, even as my interest in it was waning, I stuck with it for a while because it funded my further training so that by the time I stepped back completely, I would have done enough training that I was sort of teaching in the way that I wanted to teach. And if my training had to then slow down, that would be fine. But I had a sense of a few programs I wanted to get through and subsidize with that. So different strategy, but a strategy.
Yeah.
And that's what's important.
I just think to be budget-minded and let that, don't forget about that.
Yeah.
You know? The other thing is to, especially if you're a teacher, is to link whatever program it is to your professional goals, I think I've already kind of shared about that, but I'll just say that these bucket list teachers, if they don't line up with your professional goals, then it doesn't really matter how great they are. I'll use the example that I really, really love a teacher named Jules Mitchell. She mostly circulates in the anatomy, biomechanics space, and she's mostly a yang-oriented teacher. So I've done a couple programs with her this year. I did her book club, which was fun. And I did her updated Science of Stretching webinar just last week. But mostly I've done all of her programs that relate to my professional development goals, right? Because she's mostly a young teacher and she mostly teaches about dynamic poses that I don't teach anymore because it's not my area of interest. So every now and then I'm like, oh, it would be really fun to sign up for her 300-hour training just to spend more time with her.
Right. Okay, yeah.
But I talk myself out of it every single time because when am I going to use that? I don't teach triangle pose anymore. I don't teach, I don't care about plank anymore. So it's like I need to just have to kind of keep my eye on the prize.
That's so funny. I don't care about plank anymore. That was such a funny statement out of context.
I may not have really cared about plank all that much ever. And to be fair, I still do them. Just do them in a different context.
Yeah, sure. Oh my God, I love it. No, but this makes a lot of sense. And I'm thinking about how this discerning strategy of honestly comparing your professional goals as a teacher with what's being offered in the program is like an antidote to our ego a little bit, right? So like, there are times when I get really jazzed about something somebody's doing and I think, I want to do that, but you know, I'm not doing that and I don't need to do that. Yeah. And, you know, it's just, it's another way to pause and remember for ourselves the path that we're on, what we truly love and what we intend to do and continue getting clarity on that over and over again. So I really like what you're saying about the budget and really thinking about the programs and their alignment with your professional goals. It's all really good. It's so you. It's very practical. I mean that in a good way. I say that lovingly.
It's my superpower. For many, many years, I was a project manager. So
shines through.
Wrangling teams to stay on track and in budget was my jam. So I do it to myself too. Gotcha. I'd also just say, take the time. I think we've even said this on the podcast before, but I think it can never be said enough. Research the teacher.
Oh, yeah.
Really find out about them. And I know it's hard because so many people don't include helpful information in their biographies, but man, find out who they are and where they came up, who their teachers were. You know, you might have to email them or ask around, but you gotta nail that down, especially now because, you know, some people are connected to problematic lineages, and not saying that, I feel like they are robbing us from a bit of agency in choosing whether or not they're an appropriate teacher for us. And I know it's hard to figure out how to explain if you studied for a long time with a problematic teacher and now they're really out of favor and you've got to, but you need to, if you're listening, you need to do the work to figure out how to say that and be authentic and honest about it. Because I've just met so many people who saved up a lot of money, did all the things I just said, budget, aligned with your professional goals, and then this program comes along that it seems to tick off all the boxes, but they haven't actually checked in to see how steeped the teacher really was. And then they come out of it feeling gypped. And that just breaks my heart every time I hear a story like that.
You know, on the topic of being strategic about all of this, I think it's important that we clearly distinguish for ourselves between the topics that are nourishing to us and open up areas of inner investigation or self-growth on the one hand, and teacher trainings on the other, right? They are different. And we've been talking about both kind of in a mix. And, you know, I recognize they're related. One feeds the other. Specifically, we should not teach what we don't already practice or haven't practiced for long. But we need to be clear on the differences, and we need to be purposeful in balancing these two things for ourselves. Like, everybody probably could use a different balance. You know, I feel like learning for self-growth can, it just sort of allows this relaxedness in our relationship to a subject, and can really like promote this sheer joy and curiosity. But when it comes to teacher trainings, the emphasis is on gaining particular contextual knowledge, you know, learning teaching techniques, understanding the purpose of a practice and best practices, learning how to communicate that, when not to teach it, you know, all of these things. It's very different. And, you know, I can get caught in a pattern of only training. And that can, for me, it can kind of make me feel a little bit starved. I feel like my practice might get dry. Or if I'm starting to incorporate new things from the training into my own practice, it might feel like a slog, right? Like less familiar and nourishing, or not the thing I would choose to do, the thing I have to do because I'm training in it. You know, I'm just going to admit that I have a teacher part who is always trying to improve or expand teaching. And she may be motivated by fears that you named earlier, you know, FOMO and imposter syndrome. And, you know, I had a really fun conversation with two other teachers recently where we slowly started to admit to each other that we had been signing up for probably what is too much stuff. You know, we're noticing the impact had turned not so beneficial to be involved in all these trainings and retreats and et cetera. And also that, you know, as part of that, we felt like we were nearly always asking a part of ourselves to relax and not to try to turn everything into something we can turn around and offer our own students.
Yeah.
While I'm taking in interesting information, I would be lying if I didn't tell you that a part of me isn't running a commentary like, ooh, oh yeah, I like that point. I would say it slightly differently. Oh, I know my students in Thursday night would love to hear that. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know, and in this conversation with these lovely teachers, we were wondering if this part was helping us avoid self-led practice, right? Mm-hmm. Like self-led practice can be a little scary. You know, it's it's about meeting yourself. Yeah. So, you know, or is it maybe it's a way of staying in the head and avoiding involvement of the body and heart. So just generally, you know, we were thinking about how taken too far, this kind of overtraining is an escapism and really a spiritual bypassing. You know, like, we're learning approaches to be able to talk about them, but are we learning them to live them?
Yeah. That's really, really insightful. And I'm sitting here wondering that about myself too. I mean, it's a big question around, I guess it speaks a little to this, again, what's the underlying current there? And I can remember, especially when I was a newer yoga teacher, and we all come out of like 200-hour teacher training, right? And everybody mentions this. Like, I can't go to class anymore without, like you said, that tracker. Oh, I like that voice. Yeah. And the sponge that's trying to get more info. But at some point, I want to say it was when I was going through IYI, Insight Yoga Institute, with Sarah Powers. And there was such a strong emphasis on experiential practice, you know, going to these retreats where she wasn't filling our heads with new data, you know. Mm-hmm. So at some point, that inner voice dropped away. And I don't remember the exact point, but I remember it being somewhere in that time frame, because here I was in a contained program, but it wasn't so much about new techniques, new talking points, new methodologies, new practices. It was much more about embodying And so I am grateful that around at least that topic, that inner voice has quieted down. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to some of the other stuff I'm pursuing, IFS in particular, like, wow, I can't read an article without hearing that voice. I can't listen to a demo or someone else talk about it. It's something to do, at least for me, when I'm newer at the content and, again, feeling that inadequacy. I need to siphon off as much as I can in order to be credible. It's a difficult thing to come to terms with.
Yeah. And there's credibility. And I'm also thinking about how, for me, there's effectiveness. So I work with some people who really benefit from not doing mindfulness and in its place doing various breathing exercises that help us tap into our nervous system and start to like enhance self-regulation. And I'm thinking about how, you know, I have some tools and like you're going deeper in IFS, I'm going into somatic experiencing for more. And I'm very happy with that choice. I think it's going to help me serve others, given the kinds of folks that I'm starting to work with more and more for some reason and what they need. However, I can, in the course of a class or a workshop, be exposed to somebody leading some, you know, some breathing exercise. And I'll immediately think, oh gosh, okay, wait, I have to write down this pattern because this would be perfect for so and so. And so it's less about increasing credibility and more like, oh no, this is what she needs. You know, it's like, I need to be as effective as possible. When, you know, really, I realize that part can also relax and it would be beneficial to really allow just my presence as a space holder and as someone who can offer some regulating techniques. That's so much more important than doing the most recent technique with a client that I've been exposed to and thought was cool or was a little bit more nuanced or elegant than the one I had been leading. You know? There's so much relaxing I can do. I'm just going to say it right here. My theme for the year is to strive less and try to be a slacker.
I love it. One of my early teachers said, be a C student of yoga.
Yeah, I've heard you say that, by the way. I share that with people all the time. It's brilliant. Yeah. Thank you for passing that along.
Very wise man. But I also think, you know, the Gen X ethos of being a slacker is, first of all, we're not really slackers, but there being a kind of underlying current of non-striving in our generation, I think is something to look back on and think about more. Get it. Go watch an Ethan Hawke movie and settle in.
Reality Bites.
Yeah. Oh.
So let's talk a little bit about credentials, because in a way we've been talking around it, right? And I've been thinking a lot in the last few years about how, you know, credentials and certificates aren't the only thing that makes someone a good teacher. And I can say that out loud, but I even need to remind myself, like grounding our teaching in knowledge and ancient wisdom and source material, it's a really good thing, you know, but an urgency in acquiring certificates, right? This is related to your thoughts on collecting trainings, Jen. It can be a sign of not enoughness, a sense of not enoughness, you know, or desperation. Desperation for some sort of recognition, you know, and the rush to certify, particularly academically, right, to get the right degree, contributes to the sense that only in academies can we acquire the necessary knowledge to be an expert, right? And that's not actually as true anymore. There are so many wonderful institutes and academies out there. But our adherence to the standard, you know, like I hear people mention that they have the MSW or something else, you know, that so beautifully complements their work. But our adherence to that standard, that we have to have those letters from the academy, I think it perpetuates the authority of these institutions, which are patriarchal. And you know, we're just helping keep that hierarchy in place. I think we really need to be suspect of that. We have to be careful about that. I don't want to contribute to that any longer.
Yeah, I come up against that a little bit as I pursue the IFS trainings and deepen into that, because I'm usually the only one in the room that doesn't have a letter behind my name. I mean, I went to undergrad, but I didn't end up getting a master's in anything for reasons. But I will say, for those of you feeling a little bit like, oh, I need to go get the degree, every time I came out of a practice session from IFS, the program assistant would pull me aside and make a really specific point of telling me, Jen, you're really good at this. I don't want you to feel intimidated by all these other social workers in the room or counselors or whatever. And you know, there was a concerted effort with, I don't know if they were talking about it behind my back in a nice way, but it kept happening where they would pull me aside and just give me a little confidence boost. And I think that, you know, I think we can trust ourselves. And the gifts and talents that we bring to,
I so appreciate hearing that. I do. I'm in a program where most folks have the letters from the universities, and a part of me is envious and even resentful. You know, like if I had the time and the money, you know. That's a whole area of difficulty, really, for me.
I'd also just encourage people who are teachers, yoga teachers, this training collection and getting all the Yoga Alliance letters after your name. And, you know, that's been around for a while, but it is also starting to seep into mindfulness spaces too. And it's probably a different conversation about like how much training do you need to teach mindfulness well. But I want to just encourage you all that the experience that you gain from just teaching your students is also tremendously valuable. And in many ways, it can be more so. You know, interacting with breathing humans, responding to their needs, hearing what they say about the practice and how it's affecting their lives. I can't get that anywhere else but being in the yoga room, standing at the front of the room, leading the class. And I think that's a really important aspect of it, more so if you're thinking about teaching teachers. So I know there are a bunch of people out there, maybe we've even talked about this on a previous episode, Sarah Jane, of people going to a training and then deciding they come out of the training and then they themselves decide to lead a training on that topic.
Oh, goodness gracious.
It's the worst. The first time I heard about that, I just wanted to fall into a puddle on the floor, because as a person who leads teacher trainings, I'm so keenly aware of how much time I spend giving anecdotes of my interactions with students and telling stories about things that happened to me in the yoga room. And I learned this from talking to a client that said this thing and I had no idea. And it, so much of it is not coming from, you know, book knowledge. And you know, just for those of you who are teachers, just keep teaching. Just keep showing up for your people. Talk to them, get to know them, find out what they need. And that will inform you a lot. And those of you who are out there thinking about leading teacher trainings, just teach your students. It's the same advice. Just teach real people.
Yeah. Just enjoy it. Relax into it.
Yeah.
That's all you need. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm really glad you brought that up. I feel pretty passionate about that. And there's another thing I'm thinking about that I care very much about, which is pricing models. This is getting like a little into another area, but since we're speaking to teachers about trainings for people who are offering programs, there's one practice that's notorious, I think, and so damaging and harmful. It favors the privileged, and that is offering a payment plan where paying up front is far less costly than going in installments. So basically punishing someone for having to pay in installments. You know, it favors people who don't have a problem paying for the program, and the program costs more for people who have fewer resources. It's completely backward, and it contributes to the problem of access.
Yep.
You know, when I've offered a payment plan, the installments come to a total cost that's equal to paying once. You know, there is no upcharge, right? Right?
Same. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, related for smaller offerings, I tier all prices, you know, or you know, in other words, offer a sliding scale with price points, suggested price points. And the middle point is the regular rate, right? And the lower point is for people who can't pay that, but can pay the lower rate. And the higher price point is for people who can afford the regular rate, as well as contribute to cover those who pay the lower price point. It's like an invitation to become involved as a community based on the resources each of us has. And of course, I ask people to get in touch if they are interested in what I'm offering, but don't have the means to pay any of the suggested fees. And I know you've given a lot of thought to this as well for your programs, right?
Yeah. I want to just shout out to a woman named Kelly Deals, who I did some workshops with a couple years ago around, I think she calls it the feminist business model. Mm-hmm. But it's really about social justice and equity and a kind of non-capitalist mindset. You know, that doesn't mean that we can't earn a living, but it's, can we be not exploitive at the same time? And I know you've done some programs with her. I just wanted to name her because I did learn a lot from her workshops. And I've always felt a little uncomfortable about early bird pricing. You know, the that you get a discount if you sign up before a certain date. And sometimes those dates are arbitrarily close to the start time. So I have less problem with that than the ones that are like, okay, the program is 6 months out. And if you sign up in the first month, then you get like 20% off or whatever it is. And that just privileges people with cash in the bank. And man, I just, and I've run up against that too, because you guys know now, I only sign up for things that I have the cash in the bank for, meaning I'm saving it. Usually I'm saving for a program, so I don't really have a lot of cash sitting in my bank. But I'm very, very deliberate about that. And so it does bother me that I'm like being penalized because I don't have enough, I'm not wealthy enough to just jump on everything that comes in front of my face. And I know why yoga studios do this, because there is some psychology there. We're coming back to this marketing around FOMO. There's some psychology that it pushes people off the fence. I've seen it happen because I used to run the workshops and the training programs at a pretty busy studio in the DC area. And so I've seen it. I've seen how everybody who's going to sign up signs up before that early bird deadline, and then they drop off and nobody comes last minute. But I think at the end of the day, that sort of scaring people into taking the thing is not the ethical thing to do. And I would rather see a person not show up and do the things that they need to do for their lifestyle and their family and so forth than be struggling to be in a program with me. So it's best. I never offer the early bird pricing anymore. And I try to talk studios that host me out of offering that. Mm-hmm. Some of them will, and some of them push back really hard. But I try.
Good for you. Good. It's important.
Yeah. And the other thing, you mentioned it, I think, paying for others. I think that's a really compelling model. I wish that it was something as an independent person that I could figure out how to implement. There's a technology puzzle and how to compartmentalize somebody saying, hey, I'd like to pay the tuition for this program for someone else. And where do I keep that money? And how do I find the person to give it to? Yeah. That's a puzzle for me as an independent person with not a huge following. But I think for anybody that does have a bigger following, that knows that they have people clamoring to get into their programs, or is a center or a studio that doesn't have as much, doesn't have to work as hard to get people into the program, I think that those guys should really consider that, because it's like you said, it's a beautiful way of allowing people who have extra to share it.
Yeah, we're socialist yoga teachers, I guess.
We're socialist yoga teachers. I'm okay with that. The other thing too is scholarships. I do offer a scholarship for the programs that I run myself. I'm not able to do that when I'm hosted by a studio. So that's, I guess, a positive coming out of the pandemic, that right now I'm running my own show and I get to make the decisions because I'm the boss.
Nice. But,
I'm happy that I'm able to do that, because I previously, in an effort to try and get around studios that weren't as keen for that, was trying to figure out how I could, you know, legally collect a fund, like a scholarship fund, so that the portion that the studio wants for the body that's in the room, I could pay them, you know. That becomes very complicated. So
yeah, that's too bad. Well, hopefully things will move in the direction of making these things possible, more people being interested in making these things, more of a regular part of any registration program, because we have a lot of equity building to do. And there are a lot of practices out there that are rampant, that are really just keeping the trainings and the practices, you know, available to an elite few. So not as much, but it still happens. So I'm glad we named this. I'm glad we went there.
Yeah. I have one more to elaborate on something that you said. Because I think you mentioned pay what you can, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted to just implore yoga teachers, because it's a little scary offering pay what you can, because there is a feeling like, what if nobody pays, and then how am I going to eat? Because let's be honest, a lot of yoga teachers are barely scraping by. And I just would share with you, because Sarah Jane and I have been doing Pay What You Can online yoga class since the pandemic started. And I have an IFS offering that's also Pay What You Can. And bless my people, some of them pay a lot more than I'm asking. And then some people don't pay anything. And I'm not suffering from a loss of income for a pay what you can offer. And so just try it. You might be surprised. And just know that the people who choose zero are not doing it because they're cheap and don't care about you. It's probably because they really can't. And hopefully that helps you to feel good that you're able to make a spot for them.
Absolutely. I love that. Yeah. When I've done it, it's always worked out. It's always worked out.
Always.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we'll pause there. And I just want to thank you again, dear listeners. Again, we love to hear from you. I know I'm starting to sound desperate. We've talked about desperation a lot in this episode. If there's anything that's come up that you want to comment on or share with us about this topic, are you feeling any of the pitfalls of the plethora of online trainings? What are your strategies for managing your time and making it through this strange, strange time that we live in? Please, please reach out.
Yes. And also remember to pick up End of Your World, the book by Adya Shanti, and get in touch for our March book club episode, Dharma Book Club. So we'll again include a link to grab the book from an independent bookseller in our show notes.
And don't forget, you can use our new voicemail at speakpipe.com/skillfulmeanspodcast. That's speak with a K, pipe. And you can also send us an email at feedback@skillfulmeanspodcast.com.
Until next time, may our minds turn toward those practices that engender inner freedom.